So I think it's very important when we Sach invited me to join him to the research in the Ethnological Museum. Somehow I had the privilege to encounter your object of a study. And now we are somehow in a different situation with the subjects, your collaborators. But I think it's interesting that you share with us how was your encounter with the phonogram archives, but also what were the limits, what were these cartographies that you needed to twist, to transform, to recontextualize, and to make them much more alive.
Okay, well, the first thing is that I don't know how many of you have actually listened to phonogram recordings. Gilles there, and I know he has. But they're extremely difficult to listen to because, in fact, there's no mid ranges, there's no bass ranges, so the frequency that one is actually encountering is very, very up there. Obviously, we're talking about very early in technology with phonogram machines. So the only thing that was captured in these early recordings was whatever was placed in front of the horn. We have to understand that people like Emil Tordi, who unfortunately we did try to trace his wax cylinders, but didn't find them. Early Hungarian anthropologist that worked with the British Museum. Most of his papers are actually in the Royal Anthropological Institute in London. Most of these phonogram wax cylinders actually require a lot of imagination because they're actually recordings very often, not of just one person, but of like whole orchestras. And can we show them the orchestras? We're talking about orchestras of like 30 people, sometimes even more, with multiple drums and, that's not it.
Yeah,
that's the building that is where the phonogram wax cylinders are no longer housed, right? But we hung out there, we had coffee there, it was cool.
This is arriving to the archive.
Okay. Yeah, so these are the kind of orchestras often that were being recorded. But when we listen to the phonogram recordings, we often just hear a voice. So as I was saying, a lot is left to the imagination. These are just mere thumbprints. And then within that conversation about phonogram wax cylinder recordings, how were those recordings made? Under what duress were those recordings made? And when we look at, when we're thinking about especially Tordi and Frobenius, we're in the middle of Leopold's Congo Belge. And why haven't those recordings been translated? And why do they rest in an archive authorless? This is a form of erasure. And very much my project here is about the restitution, a sonic restitution. And this is something that's very, very important because it's not only the objects, it's the sound, because it's the sound that kept the culture intact in the transnational diaspora. It's the sound in the 16th century that met Catholicism, and it's what I like to term the Africanization of Christianity. Though my project is very, very much involved in amalgamations. It's not just in the way that the slaves acted as portals and carried this mnemonic network over to the Caribbean basin or to the Americas. It's what happened with that sound when it reached there. I think the most important amalgamation that we can talk about, I don't want to say the most important because, no, my bad, but a very important amalgamation was when, in New Orleans, African music met French classical, met First Nation, and it met Irish music, and then we had the birth of jazz. And if we want to study African music, we are forced, absolutely forced, to go to the transnational African diaspora. The Palenque in Colombia, they're speaking a strain of Bantu that no longer exists on the continent. They are playing music. They are playing beats that no longer exist in the Congo. So this is all part of that.
So then during the research and also into my various visits to such a studio in Wedding, I learned how much were you interested also in these so-called traditional instruments, like the lamellophone that we see here, but also many other instruments that today also will be incorporated, that when you were sharing these recordings, you commented with the musicians in Angola, how was this lamellophone, these melodies. You try also to acquire new techniques, but at the end you told me that you share, in fact, your own knowledge. Yeah. So please share with us this dimension of instruments that we will see from your research into the concert today.
Well, here we can talk about imagination. And most of us in the transnational diaspora, we're imagining Africa. And I have a collection of African 19th century, predominantly 19th century musical instruments in my collection. Yes, I do have a collection. And it wasn't bought in Saint-Germain from those fancy galleries, because I know something about it, so I was in flea markets in Belgium and Paris. But the thing is, I was amazed that when I got to Luanda, the only person that I met and was introduced to by Jabir, who's sitting there, a Swedish man, Kabwena played a kisanji, a lamellophone, there's many, many names for it. And so that's actually Chokwe, and this is a very, very important culture in Angola. So I've incorporated, for quite a few years, I have incorporated traditional African instruments, and recently was invited, after some duress, to actually enter into the archives at the Mack Museum in Hamburg, because I was very, very interested in actually seeing the instruments that I was sure Frobenius had acquired after he had these people actually laying down their sonic thumbprint. And to my amazement, they could only show me 11 instruments, but they told me that there's two massive crates, and they're in some warehouse somewhere, and maybe one day I'll see them. But I actually played them, and it was quite an amazing experience. They filmed it, but then the head conservator, when I was playing these like kisanjis and everything else and whistles and stuff with gloves on, because they asked me to wear white gloves, then at one point she said, "Halt, stop the camera. I want to hear how these instruments sound without the gloves." And then it was really amazing, because it was like, instruments are like human beings. They've got a spirit, and they're supposed to be played. They're not supposed to be laying dormant in some box. And the spirit of those instruments came out and connected with a lot of the objects in those glass cases. And it was like the whole room was vibing. And they were just like, woo! Okay.
Well, in this photo, we see the encounter of the phonogram, the machine that captured the sound, and the musician with the instrument. And it was crucial, your critical also remark, that how many of or all of these lyrics are not translated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's all part of the conversation, isn't it? It's all part of the conversation about this constant erasure of black culture and of black and of the black body. So this is a very, very deep conversation. And of course it starts, but it should be known that in regards to music, even on the plantations, or not even on the plantations, when there was a very, very talented fiddle player, one plantation master would connect another plantation master, and he would loan his fiddle player to that plantation. So there's been this constant kind of like sonic currency that's been going on within the diaspora, which is very, 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 very interesting. And in regards to that whole chapter, from plantation then to race records, then eventually when basically the white music industry found out that they could make a lot of money, because there was an amazing amount of black people that wanted to be entertained, then they took away race records and they included, you know, on a monetary basis, music. And then of course then you go on to early labels like Tamla Motown and so on and so forth. And now we're at a stage where we've got billionaires like Jay-Z and Beyoncé and so on and so forth. We're no longer at that fiddle playing stage.
And then instead of only showing in the exhibition the result of your research, we took one more experimental step in between that was to share your investigation in the Afrosonic mapping block. So somehow the public space of the project began already 1 year ago. And there, one could have access not only to follow, but to somehow develop certain empathy and knowledge production following your trip between Angola, Salvador de Bahia, and Lisbon. So this is the block.
Yeah, and that's Sacerdote, and one of the young Gakudaristas that he mentors. And that's just right in front of Sacerdote's studio, production studio in Sambizanga, which is a Museke in Angola. Very much the dust part of Angola, because there's this massive separation between the dust and the asphalt. That's Silas. This is the interior of that production suite.
And this was your method of work, to share the recordings, to have listening sessions,
yeah,
but not to stay in this passive attitude, but also to produce new music. How was this sampling between the, so we could call ancient recording and the contemporary music production?
Well, what I actually did was I actually did 4-bar loops of some of these recordings. Which is a way that, like, a lot of hip hop and grime and a lot of like urban black music is built up. So just that initial process is already bringing it to now. Choosing the 4-bar loop, it was pretty much a group thing in a way. And I do remember when Sacerdote first heard, you know, these recordings, and it was like, wow, the ancestors, you know. And that was the reaction that I had throughout Luanda. we laid down beats and bass lines in Sacerdote studio, and then I always knew that Sacerdote would be one of the main MCs anyway on the tracks. I asked him for a female accoutrista, and he introduced me to MC Chris. And then I just asked everybody to write very, very socio-political lyrics, which they did. And hopefully the album will be released, and definitely those Portuguese lyrics will be translated. And you'll be pretty amazed. Right, Kilange?
Yeah.
There you go. So this is in the Studio Vial, which is in the asphalt side of Luanda, which is a real state-of-the-art, amazing recording studio run by Benny. And Sacerdote is like spitting some lyrics there. These women were just so cool. They were actually in that recording studio. There's also like a couple of rehearsal studios. And I said to Benny, oh, it would be just so great if we could like have, you know, some women doing some background vocals on a song that you will hear if you hang out, called No Me Digas. And they said, we're going to do this, let's come in. And they were just like amazing. And you can just see how their smiles are radiating. You know, it was just a joy. That's MC Chris. Now she's got dreads. You'll meet and see her. And that's, we're in Brazil there. And this is Suya Nascimento, who's here, and she's an amazing guitarist. She played last night. Any of you that were here last night, you were able to experience her power. Yeah.
And how was this transition when you brought back somehow these recordings, not only to Luanda, where they have been captured, but then in Brazil? How were these listening sessions, for example, with Suya Nascimento or with Chelo Dut? Suya will play tonight.
Yeah. Suya can be quite quiet, you know, so she, I wasn't really too sure. She wasn't very transparent when I first met her. In fact, I met her at the Goethe Institute in Salvador, because she studied German, and she she obviously got it, you know, and she had a lot of space to herself. I mean, basically, I asked her to kind of like freestyle guitar-wise over a bass line and a loop, and she did. We did it very, very fast. I think we did like 4 takes, and I just said, yeah, we take 2. And then I've got a poem that I wrote, actually I did write in Salvador, called Black Madonnas, and she recited the poem. And Suya studied music in Oakland for 6 years. When you speak to Suya, you think she's from California, you know, she hasn't got an accent. So she's very, very conscious, unlike some of the other musicians, you know, of the history of black music, and obviously of Western music as well, which makes it very, very different. You know, her lexicon, you know, is very different. So yeah, so that's Suya. And that's Cello, who hasn't shown up, but we still love him. And Cello, yeah, we went over to Cello's house, and he's got like a little production suite there, and he listened to a few tracks, and then he decided the track that he could relate to the most. But unlike the musicians in Luanda, the musicians in Luanda, they understand a lot of what's been said on those recordings, and Sacerdote is actually. He's born in the Congo. I mean, he went to Angola at a very, very, very early age. But also, let's not forget who created those borders, you know? How come Angola is not the Congo? It was. So a lot of the people that I actually played the music to, Cabuena is a great performance artist who's very, very involved in Angolan history, especially the Chokwe and the Sansas. He immediately connected to it and understood stuff. So it was a very, very different experience. And to be very, very honest with you, my experience in Luanda was just so amazing. I mean, I connected with an old friend of mine, Kilowanji. We've known each other for like 10 years, you know, in and out of Portugal. And he knows a very good friend of mine, Johnny Leandro, who was very, very, it was very important in Lisboa for bringing lots of new music and introducing certain strains of hip-hop as well. And Johnny came to meet me at the airport in Lisbon before I actually arrived in Luanda, because I had a stopover, and he said, my brother, you're going home. Just remember, you're going home. And that's really the way it made me feel. Because as well, you got to realize that Angola has a very, very, the longest colonial history. The Portuguese sailed into the Congo Basin in 1483, and they didn't leave until like 1975. You know, that's 500 years. And the amount of mixing that went on, it was the one country as a mixed race person that I felt the most comfortable in throughout Africa. It was an amazing experience. And though Salvador and Brazil are supposed to be this amazing like melting pot, it's just rife with problems. But that's a whole nother project. That's another subject. And that's Suya doing a thing when she was doing it right there in the studio. Yeah, and this this depicts the fact that in fact, very early in Portugal, there was when they say free men, but of course that's very sexist. Free people, free black people. People that weren't on plantations, people that weren't necessarily working for white Portuguese. And this is a depiction of one of those. This is trying to raise money for a particular kind of church, the Black Rosary, which was a very, very early brotherhood, what they called a brotherhood. But I think it's very, very important to know that way back in the 16th century, there was this very large black community which was free. And was actually celebrating their culture as well.
And in the closing program, Sach invited Rui Vieira Neri, that is a musicologist from Portugal. You also find the interview in the exhibition space, and he has been digging in this early history of African influence in Portuguese music. Normally, his colleagues only trace the histories, the exchanges in 19th century, but as Sach is pointing out in this iconography. It happened since early times. Would you like to share this conversation?
Yeah I would. Rui actually traced the roots of the fado to the Afro-Brazilian community. And he got access to this diary by a German military person, where that general or whoever he was like stated that, yeah, fado is a favorite dance and music of the Afro-Brazilian community. And this, he speaks a lot about this in his book, The History of the Fado. But when we're talking about that, or when I'm talking about that, I also like to mention Robert Farris Thompson, who is one of the most important Africanists on the planet. And Robert Farris Thompson spent a lot of years doing research on the tango. The tango is a Kikongo word. Buenos Aires was one of the largest slave ports, and there was a massive Congolese community. So Robert Farris Thompson, The Love History of the Tango, is a very, very important book for anybody who doesn't know it and hasn't read it. Please go out and get it. And also Rui Vieira, The History of the Fado, two very, very important books. So this is Gent de Rincon, and I know I'm saying that bad.
Gent de Rincon.
Yeah. And it's a Cape Verdean band that I came across basically busking near the Escola Politecnica. And their music and they themselves just, you know, depict this very, very interesting hybrid of a African-based music. Unfortunately, or maybe not unfortunately, because you can only take on so much, I didn't actually go to Cape Verde and I didn't go to Mozambique, but obviously included in the Portuguese or the Lusophone triangle and its colonial narrative. Those are two countries that are very important, and I'm sure that Kilowandji is going to talk about it, but there was a horrific sort of like jail that was on the level of Guantanamo Bay, where a lot of political, a lot of very, very political musicians were actually jailed, and he's going to talk about that later.
On November 17th. So this was the...
No, Kilowandji is going to talk now. No. He's going to talk about it.
This was the journey in Lisbon where you cross with this Cabo Verde band. And when I was visiting Sach in his studio, you see like in various ways, like in variations, how music becomes also transformed in different materialities, questions, investigation. And are these notation books that you have everywhere?
Yeah, well, this is Stravinsky. No, it's not Stravinsky. Thank you very much. Thank you. And it's a very old book that I picked up in a flea market and then decided that I wanted to do some unfixed graphic scores in there. They're basically rhythms. They depict rhythms. And I did these in New Orleans. So very, very influenced by, you know, stuff that was going on with fourth lines and certain street parades and everything else. And that's another one. I can't. These are unfixed graphic scores. I mean, there's not really a lot for me to talk about on those right now.
But how do you relate it with the paintings that?
Well, often they figure in as a underpainting in the paintings that you would see upstairs. All the paintings have an underpainting, so it's this these transparencies, these layers that I'm very interested in. I mean, this is all part of being a hybrid and the hybridities that so many hybridities that have occurred in the narrative and in the history of the of the Black community.
Mm-hmm. And also, when you go around, you stepped over many objects, sculptors that relate somehow with the sonicity and with migration as this object.
Yeah, and obviously on those early slave journeys, nobody was able to take a comb, but the comb is a very, very, very important signifier. And it's also a musical instrument, you know. And a very important work of mine after this, and these works are accompanied by the recording of three women combing their hair, one with a very big afro, one with a very short afro. It's a sonic text, because I hate the word soundscape, but it's a sonic text of mine that I did in Brooklyn like 12 years ago, and further developed this particular piece into a performance. We don't have any images of that performance, but if you come on the 17th, you can actually see the film of the. I've done four of these performances. It's called the Hair Combing Cycle Performance, and in Cali, in Colombia, I did it with a very, very interesting young group of Afro-Colombians in the Musée Tertulio, and it was filmed, and you can witness that. As Fred Moten wrote a really great essay about that piece, and he's going to be, you know, we'll be showing that film, and he's going to be talking about that on the 17th. And this is one that's made of glass, and then obviously it's talking about the fragility. Very important when we look at these pieces and when we talk about the Afropic, it's in that process, in that daily ritual of combing the hair that. Histories and stories are passed on from mother to daughter to son. And sometimes here in Germany, I feel very, very sad because there's a lot of mixed race kids that are brought up and they don't have that connection. They don't have that connection. Their mothers often don't even know how to comb their hair. So it's very, very important, the position of hair in the community. Chris Rock even did a movie about that, Good Hair, Bad Hair. But since time, I've got a very amazing book, an old book that I bought in Portugal on the coiffure, you know, from Africa, and it's been something that's been very, very, very important to the community for a long, long time. Okay, and this is a piece called Slave, which I did. Inspired by Prince, but I did it way before Prince died. I did that piece about 14 years ago. And it's when Prince wrote Slave on his face when he was in litigation with Warner Brothers. It was a business thing, but also he felt like he felt like he was on a plantation, and he said, you know, if I don't own my music, I don't own myself. You know, I'm not a slave. So this piece is The Purple Collar. It's guitar strings from various friends. Greg Tate's guitar strings are on there. Vernon Reed's guitar strings are on there. The box is actually lined with cassette tapes, but not just any cassette tapes. It's actually a bootleg recording of one of Prince's after gig jams. Prince was very, very famous for, if you came to Berlin, he would do a gig, and then after the gig, he would like rent out a club, pull in his band and maybe a couple of other musicians, local musicians, and they would just like jam all night. So a piece for Prince, and R.I.P. Prince, rest in peace.
And finally, these are some of the paintings that you see in a network-like display in the foyer, connecting one to each other, somehow taking this operation of reconnection, affinity, sampling, that is like an intervention. When you sample, you select a fragment, you relocate it, you make different amalgamations and become something completely different. So I would like Sach to ask this threefold performance that these paintings are doing.
Yeah, well, you know, being an artist that is predominantly focused on sculptural objects and installations and performance and sound, a lot of people don't know that I'm a closet painter. I love painting. And when Anselm, 3 years ago, came to my studio, he saw some of my paintings, and he said, what are these paintings? I like those paintings. What are those paintings? And I said, yeah, you know, I paint, you know. I was just sort of at the beginning of this particular series. And as many of you know, because there's many artists here, like, what are you going to do with painting? You know, it's not an easy thing. So for me, my paintings are threefold: unfixed graphic scores, celestial constellations, and graphic depictions. But there's a lot of imagination in all of those things. So they tend to bleed out into Afrofuturism. A lot of the paintings center place. There is this utopian planet, the idea that it could be beautiful. There's always this sonic crossing. And these paintings are, yeah, they're constructed, executed partially on the floor because there's a lot of like throwing of paint, but nothing to do with Pollock. And in a lot of these, and in a lot of these paintings, there's also the wave of Kanagawa, which is Hiroshika's first like woodcut. And yeah, I mean, what can I tell you? You know, I leave a lot of it up to your imagination as well. I think we're looking at another one. Is that finished?
That's finished. So yesterday we saw how the paintings also perform this unfixed graphic scores, and many of the musicians that are present today also joined you yesterday in the procession, and they read improvising the paintings as scores. So they were performing somehow cartographies of diaspora, of migration, but also they were sonic.
Yeah, because what happened was that basically I was interpreting my paintings and then I was giving the musicians information, directives on how I was feeling. So it was like, it was just this channeling going on. And it was really a great feeling. And for me, I think one of the greatest compliments I got was a woman that I know from back in New York. She said, "Oh, I felt like Butch was in the room." And Greg is in the house, and we know how we feel about that, right, Greg?
Yes.
All right.
Butch Morris, that they collaborated together in the band.
Go out. And
he's a master of improvisation and conduction.
Check out The Rights. That was an amazing recording that we did with Butch, with Pete Cozy, who played with Miles Davis, with Melvin Gibb, an amazing bass player, Vijay Iyer. It was just the most magic, maybe the most magic recording session that I'll ever be in my life, but it was amazing. But you can experience it because it's on CD, right? We don't have no merch here, right? Online, you can get it online.
Thank you, Satch. So if it is any direct question now, we will take it now. Otherwise, we will gather all the guests together at the end. But maybe a precise question. Please.
I don't, but I'm sure that Marcus Gamble does. He's got a lot of information. But I'm sure that, like, for instance, right, Marcus, like, Lomax, Folkways, archives. I mean, people have definitely been in archives, but have they approached the archives in the same way as me? I hope not.
Thank you, Satch. And we applaud the multi-talented artists. Thank you. Then we will come back.